Hello, it's Wednesday 22nd of April. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. On today's show, Gary Bowerman of Check In Asia and I are delighted to welcome back Simon Westaway, Executive Director of the Australian Tourism Industry Council. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So this week marks the start of the long-awaited two-way travel bubble between Australia and New Zealand. So there's no better time to chat again to Simon Westaway. Simon, thanks very much for coming back onto the show. How are you doing and where are you today?
Oh, absolute pleasure. I'm in beautiful Melbourne today, and I actually quite a red letter day, Sunday night or Monday morning in essence, when the Trans-Tasman route reopened. So I don't think the significance of it has really quite resonated through both communities, but certainly from the travel industry's perspective and the tourism industry's perspective, we do know it's an important development, and we see it as the bedrock, if you like, for what future selected reopenings of borders may have in store for Australia.
Great. So we've got so much to talk about over the next half an hour. But first up, Simon, back in December on this very show, you predicted that a two-way travel bubble would happen in April 2021. That was some prediction.
Oh, thank you. I should have went to the racetrack, shouldn't I, straight afterwards. I'm known to have a bet, and I do watch odds on a few different things. I guess there was a fair bit of mail that that around April looked about right. The understanding on the New Zealand side was the way the politics was playing out there, and the New Zealand. The government was re-elected there pre-Christmas in New Zealand, and Jacinda Ardern's played a pretty cool hand through all of this. And the sense was that they wanted to have a clean summer in terms of their isolation. That was the word coming out of industry. And if you sort of fast that forward, April looked about the right sort of time to make this happen. And the Australian side, as you're well aware, has had a one-way bubble open since mid-October, around the 15th of October. We've permitted New Zealand nationals or returning Australians to come one way through and not quarantine for 14 days. There was a couple of hiccups. There was a couple of local isolated breakouts of COVID in the Auckland region, as I understand, in around January and I think early February. And there was an issue with a isolated breakout in Sydney on this side that caused, I think, for a few days there that any arrivals had to go into a 14-day mandatory quarantine arrangement, which we do in hotels. And we currently have a travel cap of 6,000 arrivals a month, although New Zealand sits outside of that. So, look, we are where we're at. And I think the good thing about the slowness of the bubble reopening, as much as it's innovative and groundbreaking, we had it going one way for a number of months, and it wasn't a deliverer of any COVID in terms of community transmission from New Zealand through to Australia. So the evidence was clear, and as you can see, it's off to the races, and both Qantas and Air New Zealand have put a significant level of capacity into the market. Qantas are publicly saying 200 return flights a week, and Air New Zealand, from what I can work through the numbers, are somewhere upwards of 120 to 130 flights a week, which is pretty good capacity back into the market.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's so nice to see some action finally. In Southeast Asia, things have been very, very limited for a long time now. So it's fantastic to actually hear airlines adding capacity on international routes. And, just for me, when I was looking at all these pictures on the first day of all of these travellers being reunited, I definitely welled up there. I'm sure I wasn't the only one. But before we go more onto the travel bubble, you were just talking about how New Zealand wanted a clean summer. What happened with the Australian summer? What happened in terms of domestic tourism? Has it recovered to the hopeful level?
Well, we had a very interesting summer. A lot of it depended where you are. I'm calling now the Australian tourism industry is a highway in terms of its recovery. There's multiple lanes, and therefore there's multiple speeds in terms of who is overtaking who. The official data comes through Tourism Research Australia. I reacquainted myself with it just before this discussion. And for the rolling year to the end of January, Australian tourism industry, according to TRA, lost upwards of $80 billion economic benefit, which is obviously significant. I argue it's probably a bit more than that, but you can only go with what the official figures are. Our international tourism receipts were pushing close to $50 billion alone in annualised terms, and domestically we've lost upwards of $35 billion. So I personally believe the numbers are pushing closer to 100 billion. But our January, which is our big holiday month, the numbers have come through for that month. And look, they're down, but nowhere near as much. TRA was stressing that it was actually the most prolific level of domestic activity and travel since the pandemic, which kind of makes sense. And the numbers are down between 7 and 15%, depending on what you're looking at, day trips, overnight trips, longer term stays. Parts of the industry I know have done exceptionally well. The caravan industry, caravan parks around Australia were packed to the brim. And those traditional, easy to get to drive locations where you can get out of Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane to those holiday hubs, if you like, you know, 2 to 3 hours, which Aussies, as you're well aware, are very happy and comfortable to do. They were bursting at the seams. And our family, we have a holiday place a couple of hours out of Melbourne, and you couldn't move for a few weeks. So it's been a really, really interesting way to watch the way Australia has sort of responded and Australians have responded. I mean, we're huge travellers abroad, but we are embracing domestic travel and domestic day trips and just sort of immersing ourselves in our interests. Whether or not that's translating in the tourism dollars, I think that's another question. But certainly we're trying to get back out there, even if it's not going as far as we used to.
You mentioned a few of the domestic travel trends that you saw there, Simon. Overall, were people mostly tending to stay within state, or were they traveling interstate? And was it coastal trips more, or was it people going into the hinterlands?
Yeah, it's a really good question. A lot of this is around the car at the moment. It's where you can drive. If you're not crossing a domestic or provincial border, for your international listeners, you don't have the complexity of that. There has been part and parcel of COVID in 2020. So we actually had a very celebrated border closure during the month of January. In fact, it occurred on New Year's Eve, the border between New South Wales and Victoria, which are the two most populous states in Australia. The border itself is across a regional rural tract of the country, but it was a hard border was declared on the Victorian side and was in place for the best part of January. And there were a lot of scenes of people fleeing across the border, quite literally pulling tents down and getting in their caravans and trying to get across the border. There was 20-kilometre traffic jams to try to get back into Victoria before the border closed. And people were stuck for many weeks. Some people, I think, it had too many drinks for New Year's Eve and just decided they'll just wait till the border reopened, and the border didn't reopen towards the end of January. So we had that complexity in Queensland. In southeast Queensland, there was a 3-day lockdown, which disrupted travel plans for many people. So we still in January had this sort of rolling ball, if you like, of short, sudden, I would argue, overly dramatic and quite draconian lockdowns or hard border closures. And that's meant that a lot of people have tended to just drive to a location, do a holiday house. Airbnbs, I understand, have done a roaring trade for people that can just travel within their own state and region and can get away and not have to deal with the complexity of crossing a border.
And what other kind of domestic travel trends have you been seeing? So you said a lot around the car. Is there anything else in particular that has been different in terms of domestic scene?
Yeah, it's a great question. The other really interesting development, and it is coming through with the figures, and Australian industry is trying to have a really solid discussion with government, is what we're seeing is our regions are doing really well and our capital cities aren't. I guess it's a bit of a flip on what people generally think that happens, that our cities are forever buzzing and busy and our regions are moribund. Well, in fact, the worst change has occurred, if you like, because I'll come back to the issues of cities in a moment. Our fantastic cities, the likes of Sydney's and Melbourne's and southeast Queensland, is that the regions are up. The regions are up anywhere between 5 to 15, even 20%, almost on any measure, be it on spend, overnight stays, day trips, which I talked about before, longer stays. The metrics are really going very well. In fact, within our organisation in ATIC, we're a small business orientated body right across the country, and our members are principally SMEs, 5 employees or less, mum and dad, pop and grand type of businesses, to keep the cliche going. Some of them have never done better. In fact, they actually almost say it underneath their breath that they've had the best year ever in the last year, because if they've been able to capture that drive market or the overnight discrete stay, they've got on with life and it's good. But our interstate travel, which is the big driver of our tourism industry, I mean, interstate air travel has been down 75-80% year on year, and at the height of COVID when we had the big national lockdown here in April, May last year, it was down basically 100%. It hasn't really recovered. And what is scary, and this is what is really exercising a lot of people's minds now, is our capital cities are well off. Even TRA are admitting that it's down almost 50% in terms of tourism spend and the other travel and visitor economy metrics for our major capital cities. And why that's a problem is because that is usually the driver for a lot of our economic growth and the overall growth of the industry. So, and it is affecting products. So it's, I don't want to get too into the weeds here, but, you know, some of the fantastic product offering we have, like the bridge climb, where you can climb across over the coat hanger at Sydney Harbour Bridge, or one of my favourite tourism pastimes is global ballooning. Melbourne's the only city in the world that you can fly air balloons literally over the city. You've got permits to do so. Now, they were international facing product. Upwards of 80% of their patronage over any linear time was international visitors. Well, they obviously don't have that. And the prop-ups of 50, taking your parents out for a 50th sort of birthday gift or a wedding anniversary or a Valentine's Day type of get-up, that's just not filling the void. So this is the problem that is emerging. And it's a complex one because it's not easy to explain to politicians and bureaucrats who are usually used to the regions doing poorly. And that's where a lot of the political sensitivity is in Australia. So it's we really had to flip our argument a bit around what's been the impact.
It's an interesting challenge that you have there in Australia, and it's replicated around the world. I mean, before COVID, a lot of destinations were saying they wanted to disperse, they wanted to shift travel away from the city centres out into the regions. But obviously, COVID comes along; it's only focused on domestic travel, and the whole situation goes upside down, doesn't it? And then we have to look at how do we rebalance again when international travel resumes. It's a really difficult picture.
It really is. It can be quite intellectual here. And my fear is that ultimately in Australia, we do need to have a really good conversation. I mean, the economists call it regional visitor dispersal, which is not exactly after dinner conversation. But the issue that Australia has often had is, and particularly with the big attraction we've had with the overseas visitors coming here from China, Southeast Asia, the States, UK and the like, is that people tend to sit and flop in the cities, and then they will go. They'll usually fly or drive or increasingly caravan to different parts of Australia, but then they'll come back to that, the solitude of our, really quite beautiful, unique and interesting cities with all the food and wine offering and the options for entertainment, which we actually compete very well on a global stage. So we've got this problem where places like Byron Bay are absolutely full to the brim. Even Broome, which is, as I'll talk to you previously, is a wonderful part of Australia. They are absolutely full at the inn. There's been no question. It's been West Australians just getting up there. They're not competing against any interstate or even international traveller to get to these destinations. So people have used their heads and gone, I can go somewhere that we knew international visitors went to. I'll get in. I might have to pay a higher price to what probably that they would like to, but they'll know they'll get the experience. So it's been a real issue for our industry, because as the borders, we hope, progressively reopen over the next 6, 12, 18, 24 months, I guess we'll probably talk a bit about this in a moment, this whole issue around do we really want these international tourists back here in Australia is going to really start to resonate in some parts of our country who are starting to get used to the fact that they're not competing against international visitors, which it's an oxymoron argument, because it's that value that the international tourism market brings to this country and all the flights that come here, and of course Aussies jump on them to go out. That has created this great dynamism in this industry, which of course has been so cruelly, cruelly impacted with the with coronavirus.
So let's get back to travel bubbles then, which of course I guess is what everybody wants to think about and talk about at the moment. So can you first kind of quantify what this two-way travel bubble could mean for the travel industry over the coming months?
Well, yeah, absolutely, Hannah. Look, it's a significant development. There's parts of the Australian tourism industry that are pretty sort of nonplussed about the travel bubble, to be honest. And let me explain quickly what that is about. It's because that New Zealand visitors to Australia have always come in big numbers because of our geography. It's our Paris to London, if that makes sense. But they've traditionally not been big tourists and big travellers. What they have been is visiting friends and relatives, flying and flopping when they do want to recreate. And also between Australia and New Zealand, in essence, you can work in either country with no real issues around permits and so forth. So it really, quite frankly, should be a domestic air route, which is probably a conversation for another day. But so at the moment, it is what it is. And so what we'll have to see transpire is just how quickly this market gets back up to where it used to be. Now, the airlines, Alan Joyce from Qantas in particular, has been very upbeat, but he thinks he can get capacity for the group back up to where it was pre the virus pretty quickly. And obviously, they're all well on their way to doing that. It's a competitive air route. It's a 3.1, 3.2 million a year PAX route. Hundreds of flights a week, mainly narrow-body product back and forward. And it's highly efficient because it actually suits the airlines really well to make this route work, which I think is why in your introduction, obviously very enthusiastic about the airlines embracing this route. For Qantas and Air New Zealand, it's an absolute lifeline to get their international business model back up and running. The challenge will be that the next sort of opportunities selectively, because I think this is the way Australia is going to go, is down this selective reopening, will be around the South Pacific from both sea and air, again, because it suits a narrow body type of model. But obviously the key market, and of course it's the one of our interest and all the senior tourism leaders in this country, we want to see how we can effectively re-engage with Asia, because Asia is our future in terms of international visitation, and it was obviously the fast growing part of the market, and it's the one that we obviously want to get back into. And Singapore is top of that agenda at the moment, and the talks we understand are remaining pretty promising.
In terms of the timing of the bubble opening, you mentioned that the inbound numbers, I mean, actually when it was a one-way bubble from New Zealand, the inbound numbers weren't huge, were they? But this real sense of optimism about outbound numbers, actually being able to go and have a holiday or to go and see family and friends in New Zealand. And the timing of the bubble is around about coming up to the winter season, the ski season. Do you think that will have a boost?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Some people have cynically said it's about a Queenstown bubble, and probably a Queensland bubble on this side, because New Zealanders love going to southeast Queensland in particular. Sunshine Coast has always been a very popular destination for New Zealand visitors. In Queenstown, the South Island of New Zealand's been highly appealing to that quite dynamic and interesting ski community on the east coast of Australia, who obviously embrace Queenstown for what it is, a stellar destination in its own right. It will be VFA driven and generated, and at the moment that's the case. You probably saw those early pictures. It was very much mothers and fathers and grandparents reacquainting themselves with each other and trying to get a normalcy back in life. And I know numbers of friends who are shooting back and forth just to catch up with mates and relatives they just haven't seen. So the tourism and travel element of it, I think, will start to evolve. You're right, particularly into winter for New Zealand, where the South Island in particular comes into its own as a global leading destination. And equally for Australia, the opportunity, and we're seeing some of the new route development that's occurring. Qantas are putting their own tail flying between Auckland and Gold Coast. They would never have considered doing that pre-coronavirus. Air New Zealand are going to do a direct flight between Auckland and Hobart in Tasmania. And Hobart's had business strategies for years on how to attract an international flight. They had an international airport in name only, but they're going to start getting, I think, 2 to 3 return flights a week direct from Auckland into Hobart. So that's very exciting. Whether or not all this holds over the next 6, 12, 18 months, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But I think the benefit of the travel bubble, and you guys have talked a bit about this, is that you've got to give a bit to get a bit back. What the Australian tourism industry has to realise is that New Zealand visitors will probably do more tourism and travel and better engage with the visitor economy because they've got no other real option moving forward. So I think we will see people travel more to and through Kiwi visitors coming here. But it is also telling our authorities here that, yep, we've got other markets that we want to reopen and maybe more complicated or complex or different, but nonetheless, the fundamentals of the Trans-Tasman route will, I think, hold firm moving forward. And I think that's the really exciting, I guess, macroeconomic opportunity that's come out of this.
So you mentioned just now that the major segment really who are traveling first is the VFR segment, and that makes a lot of sense, right? They've really got that kind of need to go and travel. In general then, are you seeing Australians, New Zealanders, are they eager to travel outside of this VFR segment, or are they taking more of a wait and see approach?
That's a great question, Hannah. We are seeing more people traveling for business again. I personally do probably every fortnight, I'm doing an interstate Australian Air work trip, and I do my taxi driver poll. Admittedly, I use the same taxi group, but I actually write them down, and it's gone from about 2 months ago that their business was about 30% of what it usually is. And my wonderful driver last night was saying it's about 80-85% back sign. So, and it does feel it at the airports. The lounges are busier. You can count the suits on the plane, and it's becoming, I think it's starting to really get back to where it needs to be. Now, there'll be an undercurrent of business travel that won't return. It's probably a combination of government travel. Government employees may not be incentivized to travel like they used to be. But I think we are going to see a lot more people traveling for business, and already that is the case. And it's now not novel to be on a plane. In a pub conversation, you know, 6-8 weeks ago, people were fascinated. I used to put things on Facebook and say, I'm on a plane today, and people would be inundating me going, oh my God, what's it like? What's it like? And we're now, it's clearly normalizing itself again. The issue will be, though, where will their high watermark be? My sad sense is I don't think we're going to get the domestic and interstate air travel numbers, and indeed probably even on the Trans-Tasman, back to where it was for another 2 to 3 years. That's just my fear. That it will get to sort of a high watermark, which will sit probably somewhere around 20 to 30% below what it used to be pre the virus. If that's the case, we're going to have to cut the cloth to suit the new times.
One of the key points that makes the Trans-Tasman bubble so interesting, I think, for listeners in our region, is the fact that all we hear about here at the moment is vaccines. Vaccines are the only way to reboot travel. But the Trans-Tasman bubble doesn't actually require a vaccine at present to be quarantine free. Do you think that will change as the rollout continues?
Yeah, it's a great question. So look, the irony of all of this is both Australia and New Zealand have very low levels of, you know, of current coverage of vaccine in terms of first dose. It's the biggest political issue in the country at the moment. Our Prime Minister's lost numerous points in polling because our vaccine rollout program's been stymied because we backed the wrong horse to a degree in AstraZeneca. So you're absolutely right. New Zealand has a very low percentage of the population covered. So in some ways, I think Australia, New Zealand and the Trans-Tasman route is a little bit unique. So let's take it a step forward. So for the travel industry, particularly the outbound industry, the South Pacific is very attractive, as it is for New Zealand. And Cook Islands has a travel bubble arrangement in place out of Auckland from the New Zealand ends, as I understand for the moment. But the Cook Islands is probably going to come potentially online for Australia. And then you look at, you know, Fiji and Vanuatu, there's probably other opportunities. And the likes of Qantas and New Zealand will step up to the plate because they'll be able to see the opportunity to make it work within the safety envelope that they've established. So that's what's going to be interesting. But what we have to keep in mind is, and you're right to your question, this is where things are going to slow up a little bit, is that Australian vaccination rates are going to have to get a hell of a lot higher, as they are in New Zealand, if a South Pacific government, as desperate as they would be for visitors and returning tourists, genuine tourists, because people go to these places to be a tourist, you know, they in essence have never really had the virus, hasn't hit their communities, has in both of Australia and New Zealand. But if our vaccination rates aren't high enough, there's going to be a lot of reticence there. So this is going to have to play out. You're going to need to have vaccinated audiences to be able to move people backwards and forwards. And then obviously then you need processes and protocols in place, which is where the Singapore opportunity for Australia, it sort of sits like a green light in terms of the Asia entry. It's nobody dismisses it. Everybody thinks it's a goer. And obviously Singapore's had the welcome mat out to Australia for a long time now, as it has a number of countries. And there's good relationships between the Australian and Singapore government. That's why we've got to work through what we need to put in place to be able to make a Singapore Australia bubble work. And it may well be selective. It may well be coming in and out only, say, to Sydney or a Melbourne or even a Cairns in the early days then to see if that works. But it's obviously highly attractive, and getting into a gateway market like Singapore with all of its first world health and security and safety processes is obviously attractive to everybody, and we really want to explore that further with government.
What would that mean, Simon, in terms of, I mean, Singapore does make sense to Australia for so many reasons, but how would that alter the balance of the bubble with New Zealand? And would New Zealand and Australia enter a bubble with Singapore together? I mean, there's a lot of issues there, I guess.
Yeah, it's a good point. And you would think that Australia and New Zealand are now pretty much at lockstep, because the Cook Islands is an outbound route for Australians. It's not a big route, but obviously the travel industry do sell it quite prolifically, and obviously New Zealand has a level of connectivity with the Cook Islands, which is goes beyond the economic. It's obviously a social and cultural connection there. You would think that there's an opportunity here for the ANZAC Alliance of Australia and New Zealand, to be able to go to destinations now and go, well, look, we've got this in place. If we do something in the South Pacific from both a social, economic and political reason, then how do we then engage in parts of Asia that we think we can collectively engage with? So I think it makes a lot of sense. And it's spot on. The moment that, and this is the complexity around travel bubbles, as we all know, is they're not easy to get up because travellers are travellers. They don't all go A to B. They'll go A, B, C, and they might go A, B, B1, B2, and then get to C. So there's no consistency. This is fantastic side story. When we started the one-way bubble between New Zealand and Australia in mid-October, I almost got the giggles to myself. Within 24 hours, there was media stories around New Zealanders, including some poor New Zealand student who just quite obviously booked a flight. He wanted to go to Adelaide, so he had to go via Sydney. So he went Auckland, Sydney, Adelaide. Of course, he didn't get caught up in the quarantine web in Sydney. He got on the plane at Sydney and went to Adelaide, never left the airport. But when the poor kid got to Adelaide, he got thrown into a hotel and was almost thrown the book at until someone actually picked up the phone from Canberra and said, actually, he's entitled to do that because that's what a safe travel zone represents. And the poor guy was let out and he had about 10 metre in front of him on the doorstep of the hotel. He was very nice about it and just said he enjoyed his free night in a hotel. But I guess this is the point, isn't it? Like, once we start to open these up, we do need to have, how clearances and processes and how we're going to ensure that people don't get through the net, be it they have a vaccine passport or not, or have a safe travel zone where both countries have the protocols in place to process people.
So I guess at this point, Simon, this is, this bubble is open. We're really hoping that a Singapore, Hong Kong bubble will be announced either today or sometime this week. This is the kind of point where we start to run before we can walk, and we start to hope that things can open up a lot quicker than in reality they probably can. But looking ahead, Simon, and we looked ahead when you spoke with us on December about what could happen in the first quarter of this year, and now we're looking ahead a little bit further. You've mentioned Singapore. We've looked at, how that might with the South Pacific and with New Zealand. But looking ahead, what steps should Australia be thinking about now in terms of rebooting its inbound and its outbound travel economy, even if they don't happen immediately?
Yeah, well, look, this is a really important point. There's a few things that we need to do. Firstly, we've got to continue with our vaccination program. Like it or lump it, and there's parts of Australia that don't want this. We've got to have it rolled out. There's a lot of pressure being put on collective governments across Australia to get the processes in place and get it out the door. I mean, they're vaccinating millions of people a day in the US, and we're lucky to do a few thousand. So for an intelligent country like Australia, we're behind the eight ball. So that has to happen. But you're right, in terms of the processes, there's probably a few things that we need to get right. We certainly need to embrace some level of vaccine passport that can match up with other countries. And so we've got to be quite agnostic about this and realise that there's benefit. It's obviously going to be benefits for travel, but there's obviously Australians will travel overseas if you let them because we're big travellers. But importantly, we can get good commercial trade back, be it tourists, business visitors, international students, indeed backpackers from parts in particular parts of Asia in the first step. The other few things we need to do is we do need to lay down what we need to do with each government and get the agreements in place. There's some quite interesting models that I'm starting to read about and hearing about around the world around, is there some type of mandatory short-term hotel stay that will help support a long-haul flight travel bubble, if that makes sense? So it is that you go in, you may come out of Singapore or indeed Malaysia or Korea or Japan, you'll come into, say, Australia, and may well be you come into one or two destinations and you have to go into a hotel, not for 14 days, possibly for say 2 days, and do a PCR test and perhaps an antigen rapid test on say day two. And if you have a vaccine passport, that you'll be clear and be able to move. And as I understand, in some countries they're actually saying that you need to have a test after about day six or day seven. Similar, I think, to what some of the Singapore, Hong Kong protocols they were putting in place for their prospective bubble. Nonetheless, I think that's important, and I think you have to look and be prepared to be lateral as much as we can. And we need governments to recognise that the inbound industry is very important to us and that we're an open economy and we do require that two-way process. approach, which was why I'm very upbeat and bullish about Singapore. And I think we actually could get it up in the last quarter of this calendar year, 2021, possibly early 2022. One would have thought Japan or South Korea would have been Monty's, but obviously with the proliferation of the virus in those countries, or the, I guess, the reboot of the third or fourth waves, I think they're up to it. Let's probably put those down the list a bit. But you look at them and possibly a Taiwan as other potential test case for that longer haul, or if like short haul, long haul, Asia into Australia.
What about Vietnam? Vietnam sometimes gets mentioned. Do you think that's on the radar?
Oh, I think Vietnam would be a really exciting market. Now, it's not really an inbound market for Australia, but interestingly, Australia and Vietnam have a lot of connectivity, as yourself and Hannah would well appreciate. The Qantas Group had a long-term investment in one of the airlines in Vietnam, which is now no longer the case. And post-war, the connectivity between Australians and Vietnamese is very, very high, and we have a lot of Vietnamese Australians. So that would make a lot of sense. Vietnam's not really spoken about, which is interesting. And you're right, they performed well while the rest of the world sort of, it's been virus central. Vietnam's managed to put the processes in place and has inoculated itself very well. It would be a good one. I think Vietnam's probably, we don't have enough conversation about Vietnam, and we need to urge our authorities, our Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, our Home Affairs, which look after the border arrangements here in our country, to be more embracing of Vietnam. I think Singapore is the first port of call for the South, broader Asia, for Australia. It's the one that makes clearer sense. There's a protocol and there's an understanding between both the Australian and Singapore governments. It goes back a long way. We think that's the opportunity.
Absolutely fascinating, Simon. I could talk to you all day. This is such an interesting time. Let's hope that things turn out a little bit more positive over the next few months. But just before we finish, we've talked about your business travel. We've talked about the Australian and travel sector and the region. What about personally? Are you taking any holidays the rest of the year? Have you got any plans?
Well, we did a COVID thing. We took a place down the coast, so we just tend to flop there. But it's a great question. I mean, my wife is an amazing traveler. She's just been busting at the bit to get away overseas. I've sort of tried to counsel friends and family, because I have lots of people give me a call and say, what do you reckon? And I said, I think 2021 shot internationally, but I think 2022 is a different discussion. And I do talk about Singapore, and everyone gets very excited about Singapore because it offers so much for people. Yeah, look, we'll do some interstate travel later in the year. We've just been doing our discovery around Victoria. We'll do a trip up to New South Wales later this year. In many ways, I'm probably the worst person to ask this question in some sense. I've got three children right in the eye of weekend sport and activities and parties and sleepovers and all of that stuff. So we have very little time as either a couple or as a family to really do much travel at the moment. But I think our first Asian destination will be Singapore. We'd love it to be Thailand because of our family connectivity there. But and we think Singapore would be fabulous to get back there, and hopefully by early 2022.
Absolutely fabulous. Thanks so much, Simon, for your insights and your time. So that brings us to the end of this week's Trans-Tasman edition of the show. We hope that you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and your comments on anything that we discussed with Simon or anything that we missed out. Please drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the SE Asia Travel Show or on Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us, as that helps other people to find the show.
So that's a wrap for this week. We're both off to dig out our old Australia holiday photos, and we look forward to talking Southeast Asia travel and tourism very soon.